loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two big stories. First, in a bold move that has taken Washington, D.C. by surprise, North Korea has told South Korean diplomats that it is willing to engage in direct discussions with the United States regarding its nuclear program. What North Korea wants, they say, is a security guarantee from Washington. In addition, progress was made towards a historic summit between South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Then we look at the big economic stories of the week. Loud and Clear has a new feature, a weekly segment on the economic news of the day, and we're going to focus in particular on Donald Trump's announced 25% and 10% tariffs for steel and aluminum, respectively. We're going to talk about what a trade war might look like.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the West Virginia State Senate today agreed to give striking teachers and all other state employees the 5% raise they had sought, a move that will likely end the walkout, which began on February 22nd. Next, no doubt you know about the infamous Steele dossier written by former British spy Christopher Steele. Well, it turns out there was a second Steele dossier. Meanwhile, the death in London of a Russian ex-spy who worked as a double agent for the UK government has prompted allegations of an assassination attempt. Then, the last four high schools in the working-class Chicago neighborhood of Englewood closed recently, as Mayor Rahm Emanuel's appointed school board responded to gentrification trends. But now, the poor and people of color will have to be bussed out of their neighborhoods to get an education. And then, it's the dirty little secret of Big Pharma. The American taxpayer is funding Big Pharma's research and development primarily through the National Institutes of Health. So where do all those pharmaceutical profits go? Straight into the pockets of corporate leaders and investors. And finally, Thad Cochran, the Republican senior senator from Mississippi, announced yesterday that he is resigning effective April 1st due to ill health. Both of that state's Senate seats will now be up for grabs in November and will pit the establishment right wing against the alt-right. And in other headlines, primary elections are being held in Texas today for a variety of state and federal offices. With an eye toward taking back control of the House of Representatives, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has been investing heavily in several races to support candidates they consider to be more electable in the general election. Polls close between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and results are expected to start coming in shortly thereafter. France and the U.K. called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the situation in Syria and the implementation of a ceasefire first agreed to on February 24th. Western powers have been fiercely critical of the government's offensive into the Damascus suburb of eastern Ghouta, but the government counters that this is a necessary military operation to rid the area of terrorist factions. The Security Council meeting is expected to be held tomorrow. Megan Berry, the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee, resigned from office today after pleading guilty to a felony theft charge related to an extramarital affair she was having. Berry was elected in 2015 and must now reimburse the city $11,000 and serve 3 years probation as part of her plea deal. David Briley, who was Berry's vice mayor, has taken over as acting mayor of the city. Police in East Lansing, Michigan, made 24 arrests at a protest against prominent white supremacist Richard Spencer. Spencer was in town to deliver a speech at Michigan State University. Police say that charges against the protesters include felonies. And those are today's headlines. Next, we take a look at North and South Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Korea and inter-Korean relations in a bold move that has taken Washington by surprise. North Korea said today that it was willing to discuss possibly scrapping its nuclear program if the United States was willing to discuss security guarantees. We are joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. And from Washington, D.C. by Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based investigative journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea, and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. and his work has appeared in many publications in the United States and abroad. Someone who is very, very well known in Korea. Welcome, Simone, and welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Tim, I think none of us would, well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe some of us thought it. I didn't quite think a year ago that the DPRK would say in any shape or form, and of course it's very early in the process, that they would consider or have discussions leading to the consideration of the possible end of their nuclear program. And of course they haven't said those words, but that seems to be the message coming back from the South Korean envoys who visited the DPRK and met there. And of course, by doing so, it removes the last obvious or public rationale or hurdle that Washington has thrown up for engaging in dialogue with the DPRK. When you heard this news, what was your take?
My take was, first, elation. I'm so happy they reached this agreement. And I also felt very strong admiration for President Moon Jae-in of South Korea for really pressing this peace agenda, you know, through the last year and during the Olympics, in many cases against the objections of the United States. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for putting this together. But I think that the agreement that we were hearing from the South Korean diplomats who just returned from Pyongyang is similar to what we've heard North Korea say before. I mean, for years they've been saying, you know, they'd be willing to negotiate with the U.S. if the U.S. drops its hostile policy. And by hostile policy, they mean, you know, being threatened with nuclear weapons. They mean economic sanctions. And they mean these massive U.S.-South Korean military exercises that take place, you know, twice a year. And they want to have normalization. They want to go back to, you know, the agreement that they reached with President Clinton in the 1990s. But I think that it's very important that they've agreed to, they apparently said they would understand if U.S.-South Korean military exercises continued in sort of their initial phase, not with all these additional, with all these additional exercises they were going to do. And they said they would, you know, start talking with the United States on the basis of ending, you know, the hostile policy and normalization. So I think it's kind of what they've been saying all along, but the crisis over the last year, you know, has really made it very crystal clear what the differences are. The other thing I would say is that, you know, a year ago in January, Kim Jong-un said that would be the year they completed their, you know, nuclear program. And in fact, it was. And they made, you know, one test over the last year, but they also tested many missiles. And they got to the point where they felt they had somewhat of a military parity with the United States and could negotiate from a position of strength. So, you know, I think all of that has played into this.
Professor Simone Chun is another guest. That was the voice of Tim Shorrock. We're talking about the announcement from South Korean diplomats that North Korea is willing to engage in talks with the United States and, of course, with South Korea on issues including its nuclear program. Professor Chun, Tim has said, you know, Moon Jae-in deserves a lot of credit for bringing the situation to where it is, and it was in a pretty dire straits not so long ago. We had in September Donald Trump, from the podium of the UN General Assembly, considered the premier moment for global diplomacy, threatening to, quote, totally annihilate another member state, that would be DPRK, and speaking disparagingly about its head of state as Little Rocket Man. The other side of this equation is what the North Koreans are doing. And the North Koreans are caricatured, I think, in the media as being rogue or out of control. I consider that their performance here over the past couple of years has demonstrated a certain sort of sagacity and suppleness in terms of how to play the game, at least. And in some ways, if we look back at the big picture, Obama adopted the doctrine known as strategic patience, meaning he was just going and the U.S. would just ignore North Korea. North Korea took advantage of that time period to actually develop more advanced nuclear and missile technology, and then has shown a willingness to really, as Tim was pointing out, a real flexibility here for the talks, including not insisting that the war exercises be a precondition or the cancellation of them be a precondition. It seems to me that the DPRK leadership has charted a course that, while their hand may not have been very strong, it's been very well played, and they are now in a position where the U.S. is, in a way, both politically and for other circumstances, compelled to actually start a discussion, something that had been suspended by the Obama administration. What's your sense?
Yes, indeed. I think that, in a way, this, obviously, I agree. This is just a major breakthrough, diplomatic breakthrough. And also, as a, with the team, I'm really, you know, so elated. And also, if you look at some of those the Korean reactions, you know, it's really amazing. It says that people are saying, like, peace coming. Is it a dream or reality? Or people are saying it's deeply moved, inspired, and impressive. And they are already, some people are saying, let's open up the Kaesong industrial park, you know, a reunion of separated family members. And also there's a huge, like, outpouring thank you note to President Moon Jae-in, and who obviously needs, you know, incredible credit. And but actually, you're right. What we're showing here is that North Korea has actually looked like, you know, has put everything on the table. As you know, the agreement has several components that is both agreed. Two Koreas will meet at the end of April, and it will be preparing for inter-Korean summit. And also, they will open a military hotline, which is a very, very serious issue, very important. And they will also, you know, North Korea said that, you know, they will really talk with the United States with a frank talk with the purpose of denuclearization of a Korean peninsula. And the more, as long as, obviously, you know, North Korea, United States stop its threat. And so this has been basically, although I was on the show yesterday with you guys, but I foresaw this is coming, but I didn't know the extent, the level, the scope of the inter-Korean agreement. And another, so here, going back to your question about the Moon Jae-in's role, I think that when he was running for president, he actually laid out very clear roadmap in a way that President Moon Jae-in is following. You know, he had a very quiet diplomacy with the United States and other countries, and also he had another major variable is a huge popular support from Korea after in the aftermath of the Candlelight Revolution, more than close to 70% of Koreans supporting inter-Korean talks and peace on the Korean Peninsula. And so all things considered, I think this has been, the combination has been just perfect. And also, we should also give some credit to North Korea as well. And what is amazing about this is that this is for the first time Kim Jong-un is making international, basically international debut as a leader. And what we saw was that, you know, that we saw some of the videos that is the North Korean also already released the very, you know, intimate close-up video of the yesterday's meeting. And he looked very, he looks like he has leadership, and it really shows that North Korea, in this case, they have a really, from the very beginning of the pursuit of nuclear weapons, there was a purely defensive purpose. It was, as long as the United States, you know, stopped threatening, and they were always willing to engage and also talk with the, you know, United States and also other countries as well. So this is, again, awesome news, and I hope the United States takes this initiative very, very seriously.
That's the voice of Professor Simone Chun. We're talking to her from Seattle. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute, a member of the Korean Peace Network. We're also speaking from Washington with Tim Shorrock, a very well-known, internationally recognized journalist, especially covering Asian and specifically Korean affairs. He's a Washington-based investigative journalist. He grew up in Japan and South Korea, and he's the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. John Kiriakou, we've followed this story, Korea, you know, for the past, well, almost every week.
Mm-hmm.
It's played out. There have been moments where the whole world was sort of, you know, knees knocking, not certain whether war was imminent, whether the U.S. was going to make the plunge.
Right. A bloody nose was coming.
A bloody nose, euphemistic language for a war that would take hundreds of thousands of lives. But what we're seeing here is something that is possibly a game changer.
Yeah, it is. But that's what I want to ask Tim Shorrock about. Like most Americans, I don't follow, or I didn't follow Korea in depth until I started doing the show with you, Brian. But I wonder why we waited for 70 years to make a concession. For example, to me, the most important thing is, why did presidents of both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, over all these decades, refuse to provide the North Koreans with a security guarantee? We could have had these conversations a half a century ago. Why is that?
Wow, that's an involved question. But, you know, I would say that, you know, it's important to look at Korea in terms of U.S. eyes, you know, from the point of view of the Cold War and its symbolism. You know, for U.S. militarists, for you know, Cold Warriors, Korea is like this symbol of how the U.S. intervened, you know, to stop this communist takeover of South Korea. You know, that's the official story, and they like to be constantly remind themselves of it. The story on the ground, what actually happened, what led up to the Korean War and the division is never discussed, rarely discussed. And the role of the United States in the actual division of Korea in 1945, and its role in Southern Korea when it ran South Korea as a military government, when it accepted the surrender of the Japanese for the next 3 years, and how that led into the tensions that exploded during the Korean War in 1950. So a lot of that is hidden history from most Americans. And American politicians, people in government, you know, like, as I said, like to sort of use Korea as a symbol of America's commitment, when it's actually a symbol of how America, you know, completely misunderstood a situation and imposed its own Cold War glasses on what was going on there. And so since, you know, the end of the Korean War in 1953, it ended only in an armistice. That's what we have right now. It's an armistice, you know, stop shooting. But that's not a peace treaty. You know, there was supposed to be a peace treaty that never happened. And, the divisions kept widening over the years. And I think that, you know, North Korea has been saying for some time they would like to sign a peace agreement with the United States. They made this offer to President Obama during the Obama administration. It's completely rejected out of hand. And there has to be an end to this war that has never ended. That's critical. And I think that is what they're talking about when DPRK says, you know, they're willing to, you know, talk about and negotiate their nuclear program in return for guarantees from the United States. You know, they're talking about a peace treaty, because in a peace treaty, if you have peace, there's no need for, you know, nuclear weapons. There's no need for that kind of weapons because, you're not at war anymore. You're no longer enemies. So, you know, I think we have the possibility of a great breakthrough here. But to me, it really depends on what the United States does and, you know, who Trump, you know, appoints to, you know, take part in these negotiations when they begin, and, you know, what kind of actions the U.S. Takes, you know, as those talks get underway, because the U.S. has really screwed this up before and it could again.
Yeah, I want to just recall part of this history, too, again, because most people really, we the public, don't understand Korea, because we're getting our information through a media that presents only caricatured and stereotypical and politically biased stories about it. I was in North Korea in February 2000, and I was meeting with people who were officials from Korea. And they asked me about Kim Dae-jung, who was then the liberal South Korean president, about his sunshine policy. And I said whatever it was that I said. And I said, well, what do you think about the sunshine policy? And they said, oh, his sunshine policy is just a clever maneuver to carry out regime change, and we'll never accept it. And so I came back to the United States, and I remember giving a talk about Korea. And I said, oh, the North Koreans will never have a rapprochement with Kim Dae-jung because they say it's just a big trick or something like that. In other words, I took them for their word, not realizing the sort of subtlety of diplomacy, also sometimes known as perjury. But, you know, Within 4 months, they were meeting together in what's known as the North-South Summit, the June 13th summit. And there was a declaration signed, and it had 5 points, and it was about the peaceful reunification of Korea, Koreans becoming the masters of their own destiny, how to maintain dialogue, how to avoid conflict, etc. But at that time, Bill Clinton was obviously on board with this plan. At that time, and shortly thereafter, Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, was dispatched to Pyongyang during October, and she met with Kim Jong-il, the then leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un's father. And then soon, as Tim is mentioning, as soon as George W. Bush came in, he trashed all that. He treated Kim Dae-jung rudely when he came to the White House in March 2001, basically said North Korea is part of the axis of evil. Everything froze. North Korea abandoned the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And everything has been where it is since then. Professor Chun, is it possible that unlike in 2000, if Washington does not approve of this actual trajectory, that South Korea has enough sovereignty to be able to go forward with North-South relations, even in the face of, you know, headwinds from Washington? Is that possible, or is that not the issue right now? Go ahead.
I think it is possible now. Yesterday, if you asked me that question, I would have hesitated saying yes, but I think it is possible. I really feel there is a huge driving, very powerful force that can support the peace initiative led by Koreans themselves at this moment. In contrast, if you look at it, the Trump administration, it is understaffed, and the administration is chaotic, unstable. It does not have any, it hasn't even dispatched selected the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. So this administration is very amateuristic and unprofessional, whereas the South Korean, this team that has the experience in the from student movement in 1980s, these guys have all the staff in President Moon, the Blue House, has about years of experience. And we're talking a very disciplined, professional, and a seasoned staff. So that is one thing. And on the other, in the North Korean side, North Korea also knows that. And he's a still very young leader, and they also know the sense of timing. If this is a real, if North Korea misses this opportunity, probably there may not be any another opportunity. So I think this is a sense of, in both Koreas, I think going to really unify, and that they're going to be a driving force. Another thing I would like to mention is that as you pointed out earlier, North Korea, the way the North Korea's negotiating team now is fundamentally different from North Korea 2000 and 2006 and 7. They have a nuclear capability, so they have the confidence, and this is a major difference. And another thing I would like to point out that there is as you know, 10 million of a separated Korean family, divided family members. These, we don't hear their voice, but they're a very, very powerful force that also influence electoral politics. So, which is why you see consistently more than 60 or 70%, no matter what happened, always support some type of inter-Korean talk and diplomacy. So I think we are across the critical juncture. There's no point, no going backward. And this is time, even if United States or any other country try to thwart or obstruct, I think that I really think that two Koreas will go forward. And I think at this point, the best thing United States can do, especially from President Trump, because he has also real political interest in getting this thing done. Who knows, he may get a Nobel Peace Prize for this happening. And so I think that it's very, very important for us in the United States and elsewhere to give a full support and consistent support for the current peace talk.
Tim Shorrock, do you agree with Simone Chun that the government of Moon Jae-in is mature enough to pull this diplomatic maneuver off? Do you think that... that we have reason to be optimistic here?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I met Moon Jae-in less than 1 year ago when I was in South Korea. I was the only American journalist to interview him during his presidential campaign. And I was very impressed by him and his will to, and his desire to really to create a peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. And what he told me then was, you know, at the time he was being criticized by, you know, American officials and, you know, as being some kind of closet leftist and as being, you know, anti-American, and there were people were saying here in Washington that he might create big divisions between the U.S. and South Korea. And his response to that to me was, well, you know, if I can bring peace between North and South Korea and reduce the tensions between the U.S. and North Korea, that would be a good thing. And Trump should welcome that. And I think, you know, he was correct. He was correct about that. And I think, you know, he's like Simone was saying, you know, the government is, you know, deeply staffed by people who have long experience with, previous negotiations with North Korea. And, you know, in fact, the talks over the last couple of days were led by veterans of this. But one thing I would like to add, you know, in terms of your conversation you mentioned with North Koreans back in 2000, I think they clearly underestimated Kim Dae-jung. They did not understand the political milieu out of which Kim Dae-jung came and made his sunshine policy. And I think that misunderstanding is often on both sides of the DMZ, and that this underscores the importance of engagement. And people, you know, like what happened during the sunshine policy days was there was lots of engagement, you know, from not only, you know, diplomats, but economic engagement, sports diplomacy, you know, sports exchanges, lots of cultural exchanges, and even academic exchanges. And I think, you know, that kind of, you know, people going north, people going south is how people start learning about each other and, you know, sort of, you know, losing their preconceptions. And that's so, so important. And I think that's part of what Moon Jae-in is trying to start again. And actually, that kind of engagement is what's so badly needed between the U.S. and North Korea, as well as the U.S. and South Korea. Because, frankly, it's hard to read the media or watch TV news these days without there's no mention of South Korea. It's like this is all between the U.S. and North Korea. It's like South Korea doesn't even exist. There's no coverage of the complexity of South Korea, its political culture. And, you know, I think that's really sad. And Americans just don't know very much about, you know, what's going on in both North and South Korea, because the media has been so, you know, single-minded on focusing and creating this sort of image of North Korea as a, you know, crazy leadership. And, you know, we know what those characteristics are like that they propose. So, you know, I really think that a move toward engagement in other areas is really critical, and that could happen as a result of this.
Yeah, this is an important conversation. Of course, bottom line for the DPRK, for North Korea, which wants a security guarantee, that can't come from Beijing, it can't come from Moscow, it can't come from Seoul, it can only come from Washington. And, you know, as Tim Shorrock said, John, at the beginning of the show, this war needs to come to an end. Every war has a beginning. I think the Korean War may be the only war that doesn't have an end.
Doesn't have an end.
I mean, it's been, we're talking almost 68 years now. And then if you go back to the division of Korea, drawn arbitrarily between the U.S. and Soviet negotiators in 1945, more than 70 years. It's just amazing. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We obviously will continue to follow this. This is the issue of war and peace. This is the issue, of course, for the Koreans and Korean people. That's more than just the war and peace. The many, many issues, as Simone Chun has pointed out, divided families. Again, unlike any other country in the world, where an enforced isolation and separation of families is a issue front and center. We've been joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute, a member of the Korean Peace Network, and from Washington by Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based investigative journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea and the author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Outsourced Intelligence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series looking at the economic issues of the day. Most notably right now are the announcement by President Trump that he was prepared to impose a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum. Lots of talk now about a possible trade war if, in fact, the Trump administration goes forward with the plan. Inside the Trump administration, there's clearly a debate between those so-called free traders and those who are for imposing the tariffs. And at the same time, big parts of the GOP, the Republican Party, Trump's party, also speaking out against the tariffs. And of course, it could impact, in a trade war, industries and enterprises within their own congressional districts. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. Daniel, we talked to some people in the last couple days, people who are also following NAFTA negotiations, which are going on right now, and some other negotiations. And the basic message they were giving to us was, this is much ado about nothing, that Trump isn't going to be able or won't actually go forward with the 25% steel tariff. That this is all kind of Trump playing to his base. Do you see it that way? Is it possible that these tariffs will be imposed? And if so, will there be a trade war?
Yeah, I think that it is not much ado about nothing. I think it is actually quite significant. And the reason being is I think this is kind of how the Trump administration has historically played, where they start from a real extreme position, like, for example, in the Muslim ban, knowing full well that they probably won't be able to implement it full speed. But then when they encounter opposition, they are able to downplay it a little bit, with the end result being that they get something out of it, a more increased tariff, or in the case of the Muslim ban, a reduction in immigrants coming in, or additional hurdles for them getting in. So I don't think it's much ado about nothing. I think it's a very significant policy change. Historically, the United States government has seen itself as wanting to create a global capitalist network and empire. And it's been a long, very slow process, but that goal and that aim has always been the kind of ultimate purpose of administrations throughout the decades, ever since post-World War II. This new policy upends that trend. It starts to pedal that back. It starts to kind of remove that global integration, and tariffs are a part of it. So I think it's very significant, and I think, will it be imposed? I can't say for sure, but certainly the Trump administration, his base, and others who are part of that faction very much want to see tariffs of this nature go into effect.
Daniel, let's talk about the thought process behind this thing. The president invoked a little-known provision of U.S. law that allowed him to impose these tariffs without going to the International Trade Commission. And all he had to do was to declare that the steel and aluminum industries were vital to U.S. national security. So he could just announce this thing and implement it. And if he wants to, he can implement it fully by the end of the week, according to the press, at least. So with that said, do you think he really thought through the notion that European governments who are going to be affected by this thing were going to retaliate? The UK already said that it's going to impose tariffs on Kentucky bourbon. That's specifically to hit Kentucky because of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. They're looking at tariffs on things like Levi's jeans and on Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Again, these are tariffs that would hit specific states. So do you think that the White House weighed the possibility that there would be this retaliation and decided to go forward with the policy anyway, because they feel that strongly about it? Or was this something off the cuff? Does this make economic sense to you?
So I think that what we have as an administration is heavily ideologically motivated. I think there's not a whole lot of what we might call real politic, or the idea of just kind of dealing with the sort of basic reality of the situation and what sort of concessions can be made. I think this administration comes from this America First, you know, ethno-nationalism, which says that this particular geographic landmass and its citizens of a particular character are the priority and everyone else is secondary. And a big part of America's strength and empire is its ability to give concessions to its junior partners like Europe, to give concessions to different business interests and allow them to take a piece of the pie, allow them to have a certain degree of the prosperity in exchange for allowing the United States to be kind of at the helm of this whole thing. This starts to upend that. Does it make good economic sense? No, it doesn't make good economic sense. The last time we had a real serious trade war was in the wake of the Great Depression, where the administration then was scrambling and desperate and had no solutions and thought that tariffs would be one way to solve it. And what it did is it created a disaster, you know, an economic catastrophe, and it aggravated the situation. And I think one of the most unpopular presidents in U.S. history was the one that implemented the tariffs. So It doesn't make economic sense at all, but it makes ideological sense. And I think that's the position that they're coming from. Did they calculate that Europe would do this? They might have had a sense of it, but frankly, I don't know if it would have made a difference if they understood in full what Europe might have to do. I think that they believe in this particular, you know, ideology, and they're going to carry through with it to the best of their ability.
I want to read some of Donald Trump's tweets because, of course, they are recreational.
And that's where you get the truth.
And you find out what...
Unvarnished.
Yeah, and it's an odd way for a president, the CEO of the largest, most powerful state in the world to function. But nonetheless, here we are. Here's what he said, and people know this tweet, but I want to read it out loud once again and have that be part of our conversation. Donald Trump, at Real Donald Trump. When a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It shows a total lack of understanding for how it works. I mean, you know, previously we just mentioned Europeans threatened of tariffs. Well, if you look, they're actually quite strategic because what they do is they focus on those regions that are kind of bastions of Republican and by extension Trump influence and power. Europe knows that there are a lot of powerful business interests in the US that do not want this to happen and will do everything within their power to keep it from happening. So they're going to be careful not to target the country as a whole, but to target those areas that are most supportive of Trump to punish them and hopefully turn the tide and their opinion against the Trump administration. So they're quite clever. We've integrated our global economy to such a degree that even, you know, like the Great Depression back then, it was disastrous to engage in a trade war. And we were far less integrated than we are now. We're far more integrated now. And there will be huge rippling effects, huge downstream effects. You will see, if this really gets underway, you will see other countries and our rivals stepping in to become the kind of new free traders and hope to draw in partners of ours into their sphere of influence. Countries like China, countries like Russia that will say, hey, no, we don't want tariffs. We don't want these taxes. Come, do business with us. We'll kind of create fair trade or free trade agreements with you. It would be a huge weakening of U.S. power. And the fact that it's easy to win is absurd. They're incredibly devastating to both sides.
Daniel, explain to us why these trade deficits aren't the big deal that the president says they are. You know, he tweets about this kind of thing all the time, where he says that, you know, we've got a $100 million loss in our trade with this country. It's actually not a $100 million loss. Do trade deficits really matter in the greater scheme of things?
I mean, trade deficits are an important piece of economic data and they tell a story, but it's kind of like when the Republicans go after the deficit and say that, you know, every $1 million more in the deficit is some kind of natural disaster. It impacts things, but there are many, many downstream effects that are positive. So, for example, you know, while there is a trade deficit because we import far more of our goods, this also allows us access to much cheaper goods. So your average person pays a lot less for the various, you know, goods and commodities and services they need in there just to keep their kind of day-to-day lives running. So for example, to reduce the trade deficit and have all kinds of production here in the US, you would see the prices go up significantly and the people that would be ultimately hurt would be the consumers. So there's that. It's true, trade deficits show that there is a movement of workers to other countries or an access accessibility of workers in other countries rather than the U.S. But, you know, honestly, if we were to reverse course and suddenly impose all these trade barriers and to reduce the trade deficit so we're producing everything domestically, all you'd see is a huge rise in automation because U.S. workers are just too expensive. It's not like all these factories would open and hundreds of thousands of U.S. workers would pour in. Very sophisticated robots would be designed and built. Because in the long run, they're going to save the countries a lot more money. So it's kind of a false, you know, dichotomy and a false conflict. And it's really used just to kind of mobilize people to gain support for these tariffs. It's really just kind of a political ploy as opposed to a point of economic data.
Without being detailed or specific, there was a conflation on the part of the Trump 2016 election campaign, and since he's become president, that it's China really that's doing America in. It's China's advantage. China is whipping us, you know, beating us at our own game. And Donald Trump has generated this kind of a sense of loss, a sense of carnage, as he put it in his inaugural address, and victimhood at the hands of the great giant China. But China is actually number 11. That's 11th in the list of countries that send steel to the United States. The countries that will be the big losers from 25% tariff include principal allies of the United States. We're talking about Canada, South Korea, Germany. Those are three of the top four. It's quite remarkable when the United States government, and as Daniel's making the point, after World War II, the U.S. reorganized world politics and the world economy. I mean, that's where we got the UN to end the scourge of war, the IMF, the World Bank, the Bretton Woods, where the U.S. dollar was the global currency. No other government had the privilege of actually being able to print the world currency. They could just print as many as they wanted. There are a lot of advantages for the United States, but what the U.S. also did through the Marshall Plan, it rebuilt capitalist Europe, which had laid in smoldering ruins. It rehabilitated Germany, its principal enemy, and Japan, its other principal enemy from World War II, and made them junior partners for the United States. But part of the quid pro quo was Americans stationed U.S. troops in Japan and Germany, and they still do. But in exchange, Germany and Japan had access to the world market. They were guaranteed the ability to sell. They were guaranteed to be integrated into the world economy. Unlike, say, what happened to Germany after World War I, where it was humbled by sanctions in the Versailles Agreement on all of those kind of wretched impositions on the German population. That was the post-World War II world order. And Donald Trump, it seems to me, for his own narrow reasons, meaning it's always all about Trump, his narrow political and electoral ambitions, he's jettisoning the world order that has, as Daniel put it, been so advantageous to the United States because it meant while others had access to the world market, the U.S. sat on top of the world market. It was the one that wrote the rules of the road. Daniel, Donald Trump won't be president for life, even though he said the other day he kind of wants to be. Either by 2020 or certainly by 2024, he won't be. But if this were to go ahead, do you think it has a lasting impact on the post-World War II global order? Does it contribute to the centrifugal forces, some of which are already manifesting, say, in what's going on inside of inter-European politics?
Yeah, absolutely. What it does is it reduces the trust, especially these junior partners in the United States, like South Korea, you mentioned, or Germany. What it says to them is that the constellation of political forces in the U.S. are such that people like Donald Trump can assume, you know, the highest office of power. So even if Trump gets, you know, voted out the next term or finally, you know, becomes a two-term president, there will, even if he's replaced by some kind of very pro-globalist, pro-neoliberal politician, there will always be the concern that there is this powerful constellation of forces in the U.S. that can undo that and that will actively seek to undo it. I think, you know, a good example is sort of what happening with the two Koreas, where the United States just engaged in this really violent braggadocio, a threatened nuclear war, et cetera, et cetera. And South Korea realized, you know, we need to do something about this. We need to step in and start some kind of peace process because the United States is not going to protect us. And so then they started doing that. And suddenly there's this real independence from U.S. direction because the U.S. is showing itself to embrace this very, you know, destructive new ideology. So I think it does hurt overall the U.S.'s status within the world, and it does hurt trust and break it down, and especially some of our most long-term partners like Japan and Germany and South Korea. I think it does have long-term effects. Even if this tariff isn't able to successfully go into place, even if there's some kind of legal process that prevents it or reduces it, I think these other countries are very carefully considering it and very carefully looking at us, and they are very concerned that their kind of you know, senior partner is losing control of that particular global vision.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, too. Goldman Sachs came out today and said, well, a couple of things. As a company, they said that these tariffs could have been targeted. They were not. Instead, they are draconian. That's the term that they used. These are draconian tariffs. They said also, not all metal is created equally. U.S. allies produce many of the value-added steels that current U.S. capacity cannot fully replace. But they also said something else that was a little bit maybe out in left field, but could be important in the coming weeks. And that is the likelihood that countries like China, for example, that are not directly heavily affected by these tariffs, we know that the Canadians are, the Brits, the Germans, etc., but countries like the Chinese could arbitrarily impose their own tariffs and essentially wipe out, for example, the U.S. soybean market. So, Daniel, what do you think about the possibility that that could happen?
It's not impossible. I think that would be kind of a nuclear option, and it's something that they would really only engage in when it became clear that the United States was not willing to capitulate to any of their demands or needs. I think this would be kind of a very far stage of the of an economic kind of war, a tariff war. I think that when we see Goldman Sachs article, and we see many articles like this out of Bloomberg, out of the Wall Street Journal, out of Washington Post, what you see is this kind of univocal chorus of these corporate-owned newspapers giving the president advice and heavily warning him against it. And what these letters are supposed to say is, Donald Trump, let's negotiate. Maybe you can do selective tariffs. Maybe you can do targeted tariffs. Maybe you can make sure that our junior partners don't get hurt by it. And that's what you're seeing out of there, is them desperately trying to push back on it. Now, these are some very powerful political influence, let's not discount them. That being said, this administration has shown in the past it's kind of impervious to that sort of stuff. It has its particular vision of what it's going to do and how it's going to do it, and people can either get on board or get fired. So it really will be a major conflict within the U.S. between the current administration and these other business interests over these tariffs, because there is a fundamental disagreement between them and a fundamental opposition. Will other countries start wiping out our markets? If we start doing the same to them, then they'll kind of have no choice. That'll be the only option they have to start fighting back, because they're going to start seeing, billions of dollars being lost because of these tariffs and them losing whole industries to other countries.
U.S. steel companies, meaning the investors, meaning the people who will be enriched by increased sales, they're smiling right now. They get a big tax cut, a huge amount of money that they can buy back their own stock options. They're not necessarily investing it in steel mills that hire steel workers. They're smiling. But, the irony of this is that the steel companies flush with new money and then protected by 25% tariffs, say, against Canadian steel or South Korean steel or German steel. They may decide to use that excess cash not to hire more workers or raise workers' wages. They might do it to automate, to use that capital, those capital windfalls, to automate. And as a matter of fact, the Washington Post has an article entitled Winners and Losers If the Tariffs Go Through. And here's one paragraph. I'll read it out loud and ask you to comment, Daniel. One of the winners could be robots. Quote, some jobs that come back in steel and aluminum mills might go to robots. There's a push in manufacturing to make everything more efficient, a code word for using less energy and having fewer workers. In the 1980s, it took an average of 10.1 person hours per finished ton of steel, according to the American Iron and Steel Institute. By 2014, it took just 1.9 person hours to make the same product, with many plants able to produce a ton of finished steel, quote, in less than one man hour, close quote. The recently enacted GOP tax cuts also give companies an extra tax break if they invest more in machines and new equipment. That's from the Republican tax bill. Another reason for executives in all industries to see if robots can do more in factories. So this whole idea that what's good for the company will be good for workers is nonsense. I mean, that's like American propaganda. It's not necessarily true.
Yeah, that's how they sell it to the saps who want to believe it anyway.
Yeah, and like IBM in the 90s, they had their biggest profit year. It was 1994 or something. They made $5 billion in profit, and they immediately laid off 45,000 IBM workers. I don't know if people remember that, because they had all this excess money that they could automate and use technologies to replace living labor, to produce, to get rid of living workers. And the other thing, Daniel, because I want you to comment on this broad trend, is that the United Steelworkers, led by Leo Gerard, represents steelworkers in the U.S. and Canada.
And Leo Gerard's Canadian.
And Leo Gerard, the president, is Canadian. So now the steelworkers, and I think wrongly for a long time, have called for protectionist tariffs. But now that Trump is imposing them on Canada, and it's going to actually hurt a big part of the membership of the United Steelworkers, the steelworkers are insisting on more targeted tariffs and sanctions, meaning not on Canada. But this road isn't really a panacea for labor. People might think so. There might be some short-term new jobs created that might be high-paying jobs, but the overall trend is no. Strengthening the company doesn't mean strengthening the status of the worker.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I think what this kind of comes from is this sort of fictitious nostalgia that the Trump administration has, that we're going to go back to like the 50s when there was millions of people employed in these factories and they were all making a decent wage and, you know, producing all these materials for the United States. A huge part of those wages and a huge part of those beneficial jobs was because the union movements of those times were so powerful. The people would have been exploited far more severely, paid far more less, if the union movements didn't have as much influence as they did. Now we're coming to this time, you know, many decades later, where technology has advanced to a far greater degree than it was back then. So automation is a huge thing. Then, in addition, the union movement is extremely weak. It's been broken in a lot of ways. I mean, you talk about United Steelworkers. It almost seems like there might be a risk of some kind of rift between those in Canada and those in the United States, given that some steelworkers are probably sympathetic to tariffs in the U.S. because they see it as an opportunity to gain, whereas, you know, the ones in Canada might obviously feel very differently. But even if there's no rift there, the union movement undoubtedly is much weaker. They now have a huge tax cut, so they have this big glut of money. Robots are expensive, you know, they cost a lot. But if you can buy them without actually really taking a loss in the long run because you've saved all this tax money, that's a huge advantage, and corporations are going to do it. So the question is, you know, kind of what are corporations going to do? What we can say for sure is corporations are going to do what's most profitable. And if investing in new technologies is more profitable than investing in people, if they can afford it, which they certainly seem to be, then they're absolutely going to do it. There's no reason to employ millions of workers and give them decent wages or even poor wages. It's far more expensive, even beyond just productivity, which robotics gives because they can work 24 hours a day. You know, robots aren't going to have a class action lawsuit. Robots aren't going to get injured on the job and need some kind of healthcare. Robots aren't going to try to organize or unionize. So there's all these downstream effects that increase profitability for the corporations. And this is not a solution for workers. These tariffs are not a way that they're going to get back what's been taken from them. Organization and organized labor is where there can be real take back and real gains against, you know, this kind of downward pressure on them. That's really the only opportunity they're going to have.
Daniel, before we move on to other economic issues, I wanted to ask you a question about the White House's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn. Both Bloomberg and Politico are reporting today that Gary Cohn is telling people that he will resign from this position if these tariffs go through. And in fact, Donald Trump appears to have confirmed that to somebody at Bloomberg, that he's prepared for Cohn to move on. He tweeted something this morning at 8 o'clock that I think is pretty clear, and I want your take on it. He says, "The new fake news narrative is that there is chaos in the White House. Wrong! Exclamation point. People will always come and go, and I want strong dialogue before making a final decision. And this is the key here. I still have some people that I want to change, always seeking perfection. There is no chaos, only great energy," capital letters and exclamation points. It looks like Cohn's going to go.
And he's Goldman Sachs.
And he's Goldman Sachs. That's right. Is this going to matter? Does this matter to economic policymaking?
Yeah, this does matter. So if he goes, there will be a huge sign that the Trump administration is furthered their split from Goldman Sachs and all the various interests it represents. Cohn is a Sachs representative first and a economic policy advisor second. He was put there by Sachs for that purpose. And so by his threatening to leave over this tariff, what he's doing is he's very clearly showing his alliances. My alliance is with the banking industry. My alliance is with finance and capital. If Trump forces him to quit or fires him or pushes him out, then what this shows is a real fundamental split where Trump is saying, fine, I don't need you guys. You can write all the angry, you know, hate mail you want in Bloomberg News or whatever. I'm going to go my way. And that's really significant. So if he does lose or if he does leave, we're going to see some significant changes and shakeups in markets.
Let's turn to another item. It's something that you flagged, I believe, Daniel. It's kind of a funny headline. We have 3 minutes left. This is in the Upshot in the New York Times. How low can unemployment really go? Economists have no idea. And then it's an uncertainty that has huge economic consequences. So obviously, the Times is considering low unemployment to be a danger, which says a lot about this particular economic order, that giving everybody a job would actually be a threatening thing. But talk about what they mean here and what's actually going on in terms of unemployment and the problems that Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, again, Trump's appointee to the position, may be considering.
Yeah. So one of the things to point out is low unemployment isn't good for everyone. It's certainly good for workers because it means there are more scarce supply and employers are forced to pay more to attract them. Employers now have to compete with one another for labor, and part of doing that means giving better benefits, better pay, et cetera. So low unemployment hurts the profit makers, right? It hurts corporations and it hurts people that are paying those wages. A big part of why we've seen this huge run-up in the stock market is for the last, 20, 30 years, wages are largely stagnant, just kind of barely keeping up with inflation, which means that all that money that normally would have gone to the workers to keep their wages up and competitive now goes into the pockets of those people. I think the reason why, I kind of selected this article is to point that out, that low unemployment is not something that everyone in the U.S. is on board with and excited about and working to see happen. There are very powerful business interests who do not want to see it happen and are very threatened by this increase in profitability for working class people.
Sadly, Daniel, we have run out of time. That's Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday here on Loud and Clear, where we discuss the big economic stories of the week. It's sometime between 4 and 5 o'clock East Coast time on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM, and then other stations as the evening goes on. And it's always at SputnikNews.com and as an iTunes podcast. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.